From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, former senator and presidential candidate George McGovern discusses the life and death of his daughter, Terry. She froze to death in December of 1994 at the age of 45 after collapsing in the snow in an alcoholic stupor. His memoir about her has just been published in paperback. Also, country music star George Jones. He's been called every country singer's favorite singer. His autobiography is now out in paperback, and there's a new collection of his recordings from the 60s. And music commentator Milo Miles remembers Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who died last week. He was a Sufi Muslim known around the world for his performances of devotional song. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russian cosmonauts have finished what appears to be a successful repair mission inside a damaged part of the space station Mir. The space walk started late, but went even better than expected. From Moscow, Dan Charles reports.
The repair mission was delayed for an hour and a half after air started leaking from one cosmonaut's spacesuit. But after fixing that, everything went smoothly. The cosmonauts reconnected cables that are supposed to deliver power to Mir from the spacecraft's solar panels and collected a few pieces of equipment that lay near the doorway. They searched for the exact spot where the Spectre module was punctured during an accident in June, but couldn't find it. They returned to the rest of the space station and locked a new door onto the entrance to the Spectre module. The reconnected cables now come through that door, and they should start delivering much-needed electrical power to Mir. Russian and American officials were clearly relieved at the success of the mission. It puts the space station on a more stable footing, but the job of repairing the hole in the Spectre module will continue at least for another month. For National Public Radio, this is Dan Charles in Moscow.
Another tobacco executive has suggested that smoking may be linked with disease. The chairman and chief executive officer of RJR Nabisco says he believes smoking has a role in causing lung cancer. CEO Stephen Goldstone made the statement while being questioned by a lawyer for the state of Florida. Florida is suing the tobacco industry for the public costs of treating sick smokers. Goldstone said he has always believed smoking plays a part in causing lung cancer. A Florida man is under arrest for allegedly trying to arrange the murder of the controversial leader of the National Baptist Church. Tanya Ott of member station WUFT in Gainesville has this report.
St. Petersburg police say they arrested 52-year-old Dale Hutchins after he allegedly offered a man in a donut shop $1,100 to kill Reverend Henry Lyons. The man contacted police, who made the arrest after the money was turned over. Police spokesman Bill Daniel says Hutchins has never met Lyons and does not appear to be a member of any group, but did seem to have been following media accounts about Lyons' recent problems. Lyons is under pressure to resign as leader of the National Baptist Convention USA for alleged financial abuses and problems in his personal life, including a wife implicated in an arson and possibly lying to church officials about his prior marital status. For National Public Radio, I'm Tanya Ott in Gainesville, Florida.
Virginia authorities hope special foam they've ordered will help smother a two-day-old warehouse fire in the southeastern town of Atkins. The blaze is smoldering and releasing some cyanide gas, but officials say this is not concentrated enough to be dangerous. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 102 points at 7,791. Trading's heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is sagging for a second day in a row. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Today's losses are being blamed on rising long-term interest rates, which have increased for the third straight day, thanks to the continued weakness of the dollar against the German mark. This has occurred on the perception that German interest rates are headed higher. The market's drop is being led by semiconductor issues, which have fallen after Merrill Lynch raised concern about an industry slowdown next year. On an otherwise down day, shares in both MCI and British Telecom are higher. These two companies successfully renegotiated BT's acquisition of MCI at a price which is 22% less than the original $23 billion. And General Motors is advancing after Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette raised its price target on the stock. I'm Doug Krisner.
A federal official has thrown out Teamsters President Ron Carey's election last year following an 8-month investigation into alleged fundraising abuses by his campaign. Federal election overseer Barbara Zach Quindle came just 4 days after the Teamsters declared a victory in the strike against United Parcel Service. The decision now forces a new election between Carey and his opponent of last year, James Hoffa, whom he narrowly defeated. The Clinton administration has reversed itself in a New Jersey affirmative action case. The Justice Department has filed a brief that now says a school board illegally dismissed a white teacher and kept an equally qualified black teacher in order to maintain racial diversity. But the Justice Department brief maintains its support for affirmative action as a tool to attain diversity while remedying past bias. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George McGovern is tormented by questions about his daughter's death. Terry McGovern was a longtime alcoholic who'd been in and out of detox and treatment centers. In December of 1994, she blacked out in the snow and froze to death. She was 45 years old. George McGovern wonders why his daughter died like some deserted outcast when she had a loving family. He wonders if he and other members of the family made mistakes in the way they handled her illness. McGovern is a former U.S. senator from South Dakota. In 1972, he was the Democratic candidate for president. He lost to Nixon in a landslide. Now he heads the Middle East Council in Washington. His memoir, Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism, has just been published in paperback. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded last June when the book was first published.
Your daughter had been in and out of treatment centers for years, and every time it looked like she was making progress, she'd have a relapse. In the last few months of her life, under the advice of professionals, you and your wife had distanced yourself from her, a decision that you came to regret after her death. What was the thinking behind that advice?
Well, the counselor who told us to do that is an old friend of ours and a very good man. I don't criticize him for his judgment. It was his view that Eleanor and I had become so obsessed with Terry's illness that it was interfering with our own health and our own peace of mind. He also questioned whether it was the right course for Terry. His view was that if she was ever going to get well, she had to confront the desperate character of her illness, and he thought possibly that Eleanor and I were carrying too much of the burden and perhaps even enabling her to continue a very dangerous lifestyle. But acting under his advice, we did quit calling so much. We eased off on the letter writing. There were no visits during that period. I regret that now. I think any parent would. Obviously, the doctor who gave us that advice didn't know that Terry was going to die during that distancing period. Certainly, we didn't know that. If I could just pass on a word of advice to other people who have this dilemma about what to do with an alcoholic in the family, I think if you're going to follow that course of putting some distance between you and the alcoholic, you should accompany that by frequent calls, at least once a week, just to see how they're doing, to tell them you love them, that you're still with them, that anything you do, you're doing because you think it might be helpful to them. Alcoholics need that kind of love and support and reassurance.
One of the things that you did to try to help her is, for instance, when she got an apartment, you told the landlord that if she couldn't pay the rent, you'd back her up and pay it yourself. I'm wondering if things like that were ever embarrassing to you, to have Senator George McGovern being on the phone to the landlord saying, okay, if she's too drunk to pay the rent, I'll back it up.
It wasn't so much embarrassing to me as it was a case of being ambivalent about what was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Was I, as my daughters would sometimes tell me, enabling her to keep drinking by almost underwriting a middle-class lifestyle, even though she wasn't taking responsibility for her own life? That's a danger you have to be careful about. the people who, with experience in the Alcoholics Anonymous program, warn you against what they call enabling people to keep drinking. But that's a difficult line to draw. We eventually, I think, got to the point where we made clear to Terry that we weren't going to help finance her drinking, but we did not want her out on the street either. So I'm tormented by that decision. I have to tell you, though, that having lost Terry, I don't regret one act of kindness, one act of compassion, one gesture of generosity towards her. What I regret is that I couldn't have done more to convince her that she had the love and support of her family.
In your memoir about your daughter called Terry, you've published excerpts of her journals. And I'm wondering how you feel about having read them, if you felt at all like you were violating her privacy by reading them.
I struggled with that almost every day I was working on this book. I have to tell you that Eleanor, my wife, did not want me to write this book. She felt that it was an invasion of Terry's privacy, of her letters, of her journals, of her diaries. But now that she's seen the manuscript, she's glad that I wrote the book, and I am too. I have the feeling that if we had some way to communicate with Terry, she'd be pleased with this book. I'm an old history teacher. Terry had a sense of history. I'm convinced that at some level, when Terry wrote these frank confessions about what was going on in her life, she wanted them shared with other people. And I think this book can be helpful to other people.
There's a journal excerpt I'd like for you to read. It's on page 20, and it's something that she wrote in 1993.
Okay. She said, I arrived in Norfolk for Dad's Army Air Corps reunion. Our drive down from Washington was easy and enjoyable. He is much easier to be with than when he was in national politics. I was going to say he had no business being so self-centered and obsessed when he had dependent children. Then I thought, I've done the same thing with alcoholism. There is no difference. I will tell him sometime.
Did she ever tell you that?
She came pretty close to that. As you know from reading the book, I print some of the things that are critical about myself that Terry said. I think she had ambivalent feelings about my political career. She was very proud of the causes I championed in American politics, especially my efforts to end American involvement in the Vietnam War. But at the same time, she and I had a very special, close relationship, and she resented the intrusion of public affairs and the business of the Senate on my time with her.
This is another excerpt of your daughter's journal I'd like you to read for us. This is on page 129. And this is the part that begins, "Tonight was the first wounded child group."
Tonight was the first wounded child group. I didn't like it very much and have some anxiety about sharing too soon who Dad is. I feel ashamed that I was wanting so much to ensure that I would be noticed and taken seriously.
Oh, that must have been interesting for you to read her ambivalence about your fame, your notoriety.
Well, there's several poignant references in this book that are similar to that, where she says to people, I want you to know who my dad is. He's George McGovern, and he ran for president. She goes on about these things, and she says it is because she wanted to feel good about her own stature. She, in one place, says that she didn't want people to think she was a complete loser, so she told them who her father was. I find that very touching, but it's also kind of sad because Terry was a person who, in her own right, had every reason for self-respect. She was a person of high intelligence, a person of great compassion, with just a marvelous sense of humor. And yet this problem of declining self-esteem plagued her from the time she was a teenager.
And her failure to, you know, achieve anything, and her failure to, you know, totally give up alcohol must have seemed like an even greater failure measured up against your success.
I think that's right. I think that Terry knew that she had great opportunities in our family. She participated heavily in the 1972 presidential campaign. She was speaking on platforms all over this country, sometimes to audiences of thousands of people, and she did extremely well. And yet, with the passage of time, alcohol robbed her of the capacity to perform in that fashion, to hold a job, and to do other things that would have enhanced her self-confidence and her self-esteem.
In another journal entry, Terry wrote, "My mother often tried to help me when I went to her, but mostly I remember her wanting to change me, not being able to meet me where I was." You know, when I read that, I thought, what an impossible situation it is for parents to be in a situation like this, because if you don't try to change her when she's suffering from alcoholism, then you feel really bad that you're not doing your best to help her get well. And of course, if you do try to change her, then she could have the reaction she has here, that it's just hard to go to you for help, because all you do is be critical and try to change her.
Well, it was very painful for me to include that passage in the book. It's harder for me to include criticism of Eleanor than it is criticism of myself, because I think Eleanor was almost blameless as a mother. She was so dedicated to those five children of ours. It's one of the reasons that Eleanor decided not to work outside the home. She felt that with five children coming within a period of 10 years, she had a full-time obligation at home. And that was the attitude of most women in that post-World War II period. So she gave everything she had to Terry and to the other children. And I think that Terry knew that. Eleanor was her best friend, her most dependable advisor, the person who would always listen to her patiently in the middle of the night or any other time.
What was your wife's reaction when she read that journal excerpt?
Well, she was hurt by it. She had read the journals herself, as well as reading these passages in my book. And it does hurt her, because Eleanor has lived for these children. So for a mother to read criticism of that kind from one of her children is very painful.
Looking back now, do you think that you were too judgmental or not judgmental or enough? Is there anything that you would want to change in that?
Yes, there is. I wish I had always remembered that Terry was sick, that once she became seriously addicted, she had an illness that had to be treated as such. I wish that I had been more careful about separating my resentment of that disease from my love for her. My dad was an old-fashioned Methodist minister, and I remember him saying to the congregation several times, "Hate the sin, but love the sinner." I wish I had applied that doctrine to modify it to say, hate the alcoholism, but love the alcoholic, and make that clear to her.
Did you often feel like there were two different Terrys, the sober Terry and the drunk Terry?
I did feel that way, and one time I said to her shortly before she died, she was in a period of sobriety, and we were in Madison, Wisconsin, and having dinner, I was just struck that night by what a endearing person she was, so perceptive and sensitive and compassionate, and as usual, so funny and humorous. I said to her near the end of the evening, "You know, Terry, I don't think there's a more lovable creature on this earth than you when you're sober." And she said, "Well, thank you, Dad, but..." Then just with a touch of sadness, she said, "Maybe I'm a little bit lovable even when I'm not sober, even when I'm drinking." And I think that's true. We have to sustain that love for alcoholics even when their behavior is not very attractive.
My guest is former Senator George McGovern. His memoir about his daughter is called Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with George McGovern, he's written a memoir about his late daughter, Terry, who died of alcoholism at the age of 45. When you were in politics, did you feel like you had to pretend you had a perfect family? That seems to be a game that most politicians feel that they have to play.
Well, I suppose I was guilty of that. I always did think I had a great family. I still do. I think that one of the things I did with my family that I would do less of if I had it to do over again is, in a sense, kind of using them politically, asking them to get up on the back end of an open car with me or a truck or whatever was available and ride in parades. I think that I would be more cautious about that now. They went along with all of it, but I would spend more time also talking to my family about decisions like that and getting their input rather than just assuming that I could always ask them to bend their will to mine when it came to politics.
I want to get back to a question we were talking about before, which is, you know, when there is an alcoholic in your family, how do you know if what you're doing is functioning as an enabler, or if, you know, if your criticism is sending them further into alcoholism? And there's a specific incident I'd like you to talk about. There was one day when your daughter said that she desperately needed a drink, and you tried to prevent her from going out to get one. And then she wrote in her journal, Dad, why don't you just... Actually, was this in the journal that she said?
No, she said that to me.
She said this to you. Tell me what she said.
She said, Dad, I just have to have another drink. Every cell in my body is just screaming out in agony for it. You have no idea the misery that I feel. And I could see it on her face, just genuine anguish. She said, please, 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 let me have a drink. Why don't you sit down here with me and have a drink? This is about 1 o'clock in the morning. There was no alcohol in the house. The bars were closed. We were living on a hill in Washington that was absolutely covered with ice. This is the middle of the winter, and that steep hill was just covered with about an inch of ice. If she had started down that hill in the car, she never would have made it. There was a big ravine at the bottom of the hill. So after turning her down on these pleas for another glass of vodka, I heard a noise out in front of the house a few minutes later, and sure enough, it was Terry out in a car in front of the house getting ready to take off. I raced out of the house, pulled the door open, and begged her to get out of the car. When she refused to do that, I literally struggled with her physically for 5 or 6 minutes trying to pull her out of that car. I'm a very strong person, I think. She was a small, somewhat delicate person. I eventually was able to break her grip on the steering wheel. What I didn't know is that she had moved the car out of the parking gear and had the motor running. It was a new car, and I didn't hear the motor running, so it lurched down the hill and crashed into the house next door. But the point of that story is that it demonstrates how desperate that addiction to alcohol can become.
But I also think it shows how topsy-turvy all of a family member's behavior is, and how topsy-turvily it could be interpreted. I mean, in some ways, gosh, maybe you would have been better off just having a drink with her. She wouldn't have gone out of the house. She wouldn't have risked her life. The car wouldn't have crashed. I mean, I'm not really saying, oh, don't you regret that you didn't have a drink with her? But I mean, there's just there was no good path of behavior here.
I suppose if I had that circumstance confronting me again exactly as it was, I would have tried to get her another drink and urge her to quiet down and go to sleep. I certainly would have been troubled by it. You hate to give alcohol to somebody who's dying from alcoholism, and that was the course that Terry was flirting with at that time. But under the circumstances, one doesn't know what to do. I've had people that know about this story advise me both ways on what would have been the proper course.
I wonder what it's like for you now to be talking about your daughter and her problems and its emotional impact on you, and to have written this book. I think for most politicians, they spend so much of their lives having to not reveal things about the personal life and not reveal things about the family, because it could be held against them.
Well, I had to write this book. I had to do it just to come to terms with my own anguish over Terry's death. I could not accept the fact that her story was going to end in a snowbank in Madison, Wisconsin at Christmas time, 94. I had to tell the story of this remarkable young woman, and she was remarkable, a person who filled her life with compassionate acts and kindnesses to other people, a very remarkable young woman, but who also, through her own mistakes and her own addiction, has something tragic that we need to understand, too. I wanted that whole story to be told as honestly as I could tell it, to base it in every way I could on her own journals and her own history, and to share that with other people.
I have one last question. If you were in politics today, do you think more would have been made of your daughter's bouts with alcoholism, the fact that she had had an abortion when she was 15, that she had two children with a man she lived with but wasn't married to? Now that family values is such a big issue in campaigns, and everybody's always competing with who has the more perfect family, and the public wants to know more and more about the private lives of politicians.
Well, those aspects of Terry's life were embarrassing. But I think the public is mature enough to draw a distinction between the mistakes and the weaknesses of our children and the strength of the candidate. So I doubt if that would have spilled over in a way that would have been seriously damaging to me. Terry was also a great asset to me politically. She went out and campaigned all over this country for me in 72, and she did the same thing in state races in South Dakota. I would put it to you this way: on balance, I would take Terry McGovern as an ally any time, despite the difficulties that she had.
George McGovern, I really want to thank you for talking with us, and I'm really sorry about your loss.
Thank you so much for having me on.
George McGovern's memoir about his daughter, Terry, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last June when the book was first published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, country music star George Jones. There's a new collection of his recordings from the 60s, and his autobiography has just come out in paperback. Also, we remember Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, a Sufi Muslim famous for his devotional singing. He died last Saturday. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with country music star George Jones. Waylon Jennings once said, if we could all sound like we wanted to, we'd all sound like George Jones. Rock stars like Elvis Costello and Keith Richards have also paid tribute to Jones. There's a new collection of his recordings from the 60s called the George Jones Collection, The United Artists Years, on Razor and Tie. It includes his first big hit, She Thinks I Still Care, recorded in 1962.
She thinks friend about her, just because I spoke her name somewhere, just because I rang her number by mistake today, she thinks I still care.
George Jones tells his personal story in his autobiography, which has just been published in paperback. He describes the many years he was addicted to alcohol and cocaine, and he gives his perspective on his celebrated but troubled marriage to Tammy Wynette. Jones grew up in rural Texas during the Depression. His father made bootleg whiskey to help make ends meet. George Jones first performed at the age of 9 in Pentecostal churches and revival meetings. After helping to save souls, in his early teens he played to the sinners at rough-and-tumble roadhouses. He was underage, but he worked with a married couple who served as his guardians. Jones says fights often broke out while the band played.
Back in those late 40s, when I was appearing in these places with them, you know, we had to put chicken wire around the bandstand, the little stage we had, to keep bottles from flying over and busting our guitars up. It would be brawls break out every hour or so. But we got through it. It was part of the training, I guess.
Were those bottles intended for the band, or were they just accidentally
really
hitting you?
Not really. There's one or two that get in a fight and start something, and then get knocked into another one, and he'd get mad, and he'd join in fighting them. So next thing you know, is a dozen fighting, and tables turning over, and bottles are flying, throwing in, at each other, you know, and they'd naturally head that way, too, you know.
So when there was fighting when you were playing, would you just keep playing?
Well, we were told to do that, and that's what we'd done most of the time, until, you know, it got really too rough to continue, and then we'd quietly bow out and get out of the way.
Let's see, you were married at age 17, divorced a little less than a year later, I think, went into the Marines for a couple of years. How soon did you start recording when you got out of the Marines? And I guess it was 1954.
Right away, in that following February of 54, I went into the studio the first time, and we didn't do all that good until 56, I think, or 55. We lucked up with a tune called Why, Baby, Why, and then we moved on to Nashville to a larger company that could distribute, you know, records better.
Well, why don't we hear Why, Baby, Why, recorded in 1955. One of the things interesting about this is that I think really you're best known for your ballads. And this is really up-tempo.
Well, the first days were rough, you know. The early days, we recorded for Starday Records, and really it was terrible sound. We recorded in a small living room of a house on the highway near Beaumont. You could hear the trucks. We had to stop a lot of times because it wasn't soundproof. It was just egg crates nailed on the wall, and the big old semi-trucks would go by and make a lot of noise, and then we'd have to start over again.
So George Jones, let's hear your first hit, recorded in 1955, Why, Baby, Why.
Tell me why, baby, why, baby, why, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry. I can't help but love you till the day that I die. So tell me why, baby, why, baby, why, baby, why.
Bill, now I've got a crow I wanna pick with you, just like last time when the feathers flew. You're running wild, kicking up your heels, leaving me home with a handful of bills. Well, I can't live without you, and you know it's true, but there's no living with you, so what'll I do? I'm going honky-tonk and get as tight as I can, and maybe by then you'll appreciate a good man. Tell me why, baby, oh, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry.
That's George Jones, his first hit back in 1955. George Jones, how did this record affect your life? How did it change your life?
Well, it gave me a little more to eat and got me to traveling around, driving my car and to places close to East Texas, the big cities, Houston, Dallas, and over into Louisiana, sometimes Oklahoma. And it was a local hit for me. It was a national hit for Red Savine and Webb Pierce, which back at that time, Webb Pierce was about the number one big star that was recording at the time.
Now, how did you get the reputation as No Show Jones, of not showing up for dates?
Well, that was easy as time went by. No, I just I missed a few dates back when I was doing a little bit too much of my drinking, and later on I got into drugs and. But I didn't really miss as many dates as it's been built up to be, but a lot of things the fans and people didn't know that the management that I had around me at the time were also booking dates on me on the, a lot of times, several dates on the same date and getting advanced monies for the dates. And they knew I would get the blame, you know, for it. And that they would never have to refund those monies. So I wound up with so many lawsuits that I didn't know what to do with. So that's why I had all those problems with the lawsuits, and finally got it all straightened out, though, thank goodness, and we don't have to worry about all that anymore.
All right. You went through many years of drinking to excess and then some years of doing cocaine as well. I imagine there was a long period during which, when you performed, you were often very drunk. How did that affect your performance?
Well, I thought it made me do a good job, but I found out later I didn't sound as good as I thought I did. You know, no, but really, to be honest with you, I did drink performing, but I didn't usually go to excess with it. Until after the shows. Usually after the shows is when I stayed up picking in the rooms and stuff like that and partying and running my health and all the other things that came, you know, with it.
Did you have blackouts?
Well, I did a lot of passing out. I don't know about blackouts.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Would you get worried when you'd come back to regain consciousness after passing out and just wonder, what did I do that I've forgotten?
Oh, yeah, many times. You don't realize the things you have done, and then when people start telling you some of the things you've done, you didn't want to hear it, and instead of straightening up then you go right back and do the same things again. So I don't know what makes people do that, but thank God we've found out about it and got a little sense before it was too late.
Actually strikes me as being particularly dangerous when you're famous, because there's always people out to get you when you're famous. They could make up things that you did while you were drinking, and you wouldn't be able to know one way or another whether you did it or not, because you'd blacked out.
Well, you know, the things you actually do is bad enough. It's the things that people around
right.
you, they build it up and make it worse. So that's one reason I wanted to write the book, and there's been a couple of other books out on me that's been written from just hearsay and mountains built out of molehills, and I just wanted to set the record straight, and that's one of the reasons that I went ahead and with Tom Carter and wrote the book. Some of the things they claimed I'd done was even worse when I get through telling it, but so many of the things, though, that I didn't do, that I just like to let everybody know my side of it.
Let's hear another one of your songs, and this is These Days I Barely Get By, which was co-written by you and by Tammy Wynette, and I think you recorded this shortly before or shortly after you separated.
I think so.
Do you remember which it was?
No.
Shortly after?
But I'm sure it was just before we separated and got divorced.
Tell me what your life was like when you recorded this.
Well, it was already getting to one of the lowest points in my life from drinking so much. And this was what led to a lot to the cause of the divorce. And so you know most of the story after that.
Okay, well, this is These Days I Barely Get By, sung by my guest George Jones.
I woke up this morning aching with pain. Don't think I can work, but I'll try. The car's in the shop, so I thumbed all the way. All these days I barely get by.
George Jones, recorded in the mid-70s. I'm wondering, if you're truly living the lyric that you're singing about, do you think that that helps you make it even more expressive?
The song, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly do. I know when I'm singing a song on stage or recording one in the studio, I have to get deeply involved in it, and if not, you can't put the emotions and the feelings, and I don't think they come out if you don't.
My guest is George Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with country singer George Jones. Let me play the song that you say turned your life around. And this is He Stopped Loving Her Today. Tell me, before we get to how this song changed your life, what was your life like when you recorded it?
Well, it was getting better. I had came out of rehab and I was doing a lot better. And I went in and recorded the song that I carried it about a year before while I was all messed up, and it just turned my life around. It was the biggest record that I'd ever recorded in all my recording years, and you know, they say good things happen when you try to do good things, you know, and maybe the good Lord, when I straightened up, he was kind of thanking me for it.
Now, you had the song for about a year before recording it, and you asked the songwriter to rewrite it several times. What was the original song like? How is it different from what you recorded, and why did you think it needed to be changed?
Well, when I first got the song and first heard it, it didn't have the last verse of the recitation part. It didn't have that part for the... I kept telling them that the lady had to come back, you know, the girl had to come back one way or the other, either to see him or come to his funeral or something. And they went back and rewrote and wrote the last verse then, that where I do the recitation, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you still sing
that
this?
That was when she came to to the funeral, you know.
Do you still sing the song a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, recorded in 1980. This is George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she would. And it kept running through my mind. This time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today. It played. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
That's my guest, George Jones. He's written a new autobiography called George Jones, I Lived to Tell It All. How did you finally give up drinking?
Well, first of all, I went in rehab. And I went back during the first couple of years, you know, four or five times, just for a couple of days at a time. You know, when these things would come back on you, you'd get your sickness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about the time that I had met Nancy. And, of course, I was getting all... the good help that she could offer.
She's your wife. And,
right. And all of a sudden, one day, you know, it was just over with, you know. And so that's been, I'd say, I'm guessing around 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like the first time you sang on stage without drinking?
Well, it was rough. I'll have to say that. It was rough, and after, it was rough for about the first... couple of 3 weeks, and then each night, you know, I got more used to it, and I was forgetting that I thought I might need it or something like that. And in other words, we fought it, and we got through the worst part of it, and then those nights were over.
What's it like to sing drinking songs now? Do they have a different meaning to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's, life itself is different, you know. I thought I lived in a science fiction movie or something, all them bad years, but, no, it's, I wake up and, now, you know, and enjoy the farm, enjoy the horses I got, and just have a great time, knowing your family and knowing things you never didn't know before, you know, and realizing what you got and what you're thankful for.
Now, have you ever always taken your voice for granted? I mean, here's what I mean. It came so naturally to you. You never seem to have had to work at singing. You just had this gift. And sometimes when people just have something, they don't realize how special it is.
Well, a lot of times you can't see the forest for the trees. We don't wake up when we ought to sometimes, if you know what I mean. And I never did take it all that serious. The only thing I took serious was I loved to do it, and the people liked to hear it, and that's my happiest times is when I was on stage, and they seemed to be enjoying it. That made me enjoy being there.
Mm-hmm. Did you think of your voice as a gift? I mean, do you think
naturally.
Of it as a gift?
Uh-huh. Naturally, it's. I think there's only a few every now and then that come along that are lucky enough to have the little different sound and in their voice and the drive and the heart, the soul, whatever you want to call it. It's just a little something different that we're blessed with, you know.
It seems to me that for a good part of your career, maybe I'm wrong here, that you didn't much like giving interviews or really, you know, thinking out loud about yourself and your life.
Yeah, I was awful shy when I was growing up, and I didn't like interviews, and I didn't like to be in crowds unless I was on stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of a loner or shy, whatever you want to say, back in those days. And I just really didn't like giving interviews because I didn't think I could talk, you know, right. And I still think I don't today. I don't know. Just back in those days, I was shy, and I didn't know what to say, you know. I was afraid someone, they would ask me things that I wouldn't know how to answer. So I was really scared more than anything.
And you're comfortable with yourself now?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
George Jones' autobiography has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year when the book was first published. And Razor and Tie Records has just released a reissue of his recordings from the 60s called She Thinks I Still Care, The George Jones Collection. Here's another song from it.
I feel tears welling up, calling deep inside, like my heart's sprung a big break. And the stab of loneliness sharp and painful that I may never shake. Now you might say that I was taking it hard since you wrote me off with a call. But don't you wager that I'll hide the sorrow when I'm a right down and bawl. Now the race is on and here comes pride up the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running. True love scratched for another's sake. The race is on and it looks like heartaches. And the winner loses all.
Coming up, we remember a world music star who died last week. This is Fresh Air. One of the world's most famous religious singers, Pakistan's Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, died in London last Saturday at the age of 48. He was a Sufi Muslim who performed qawwali, a type of devotional song intended to induce ecstasy. In the mid-80s, Khan became an unlikely world music star in the West after Peter Gabriel brought him to England to perform. He sang with Gabriel on the soundtrack to The Last Temptation of Christ. Last year, he collaborated with Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder on the soundtrack for Dead Man Walking and sold out Radio City Music Hall. Music critic Milo Miles has this remembrance.
عجیب مرتبہ حیدر کا عرش پر دیکھا ولی ولی کی صدا تھی جہاں جہاں پہنچے ولی ولی کی صدا تھی جہاں جہاں پہنچے علی علی نظر آئے جدر جدر دیکھا حق علی 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 مولا علی علی
When I saw Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan for the first time about 7 years ago, I had absolutely no idea what to expect. I could tell, however, that a good portion of the audience knew exactly what to expect, and they were pumped. There was excitement you could shovel. But could such a relatively humble ensemble as Khan's deliver much power? There was only about four guys who would clap rhythm and shout choral responses. There were two fellows beating little tabla and dolak drums, and a couple of spare solo singers, including Nusrat's harmonium-playing brother, Farak. The long, winding introductions to Khan's songs seemed to go nowhere. To us outsiders, it didn't matter if the text was based on medieval religious poetry or love stories in verse. But after the drum beats abruptly went into overdrive and Khan started vocal improvising, everything changed. He would repeat and stretch a little phrase until it became pure sound. He rattled off staccato consonants and held notes until they spiraled up through the ceiling. The vocal leads would hop all over the group, but it always came back to Khan, and he had new amazing gyrations. He could provoke happy frenzy over and over. As he was possessed by the music, he would possess the crowd, and they would dance in the aisles, shriek and fall down, wave scarves and twirl like tops. At the end of 3 hours, I was pumped. Khan made all sorts of recordings, more than 100 total. Some were beat-crazy, anything-goes soundtracks for Indian films, and he could have a lot of fun with those. Some, like the Live in London series, are well-recorded concerts that deliver at least a hint of his tidal wave charisma. An inexpensive introductory collection called Rapture on the Music Club label presents Khan doing relatively short tunes with strong hooks and clear variety. Start there and you'll soon be into his epic meditations, the disco remixes, the dub treatments. Whatever style he chose, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's voice split the air.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. He remembered Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who died last week at the age of 48. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Fred Snyder, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Francis Yu is our intern. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's Comedy Week. We begin our series of interviews with stand-up comics and comedy writers. We begin the series with some old-timers, Henny Youngman, Phyllis Diller, and Joan Rivers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.